This Be Podcast Network show is presented by IXL. Loved and trusted by more than 1 million teachers, IXL enhances your teaching and takes work off your plate, so you can make an even bigger impact on your students. IXL delivers personalized learning across a comprehensive pre-K through 12th grade curriculum, including math, language arts, science, and social studies, and helps you assess student performance through actionable real-time insights. Strengthen daily instruction, close knowledge gaps quickly, and set every student up for success. If you want to bring IXL to your school, you can learn more at IXL.com/BE. That's IXL.com/BE. We're proud to be sponsored by MyFlex Learning. MyFlex Learning is a scheduling platform that helps middle and high schools meet the individual needs of all students. Schools can easily create and manage time for flex blocks, activity periods, RTI, therapy, and teacher appointments, and much more. With its built-in accountability tool and reporting features, MyFlex Learning solves your challenges around getting kids where they need to be and understanding how flex time is spent. Make your flex time work for you. Visit myflexlearning.com/BE to learn more and receive $500 off the first year. That's myflexlearning.com/BE. This is Dr. Karen, and you are listening to the De Facto Leaders Podcast on the Be Podcast Network, where I share up-to-date, evidence-based practices, my own experiences, and guest interviews designed to help pediatric therapists, educators, and aspiring school leaders design services that support social, emotional, and academic growth and set kids up for success in adulthood. Whether you want to learn effective strategies for your therapy session or classroom, be an influential leader on your team, or find creative ways to use your skills to advance in your career, I've got you covered. Hey there, it's Dr. Karen, and welcome to episode 155 of the De Facto Leaders Podcast on the Be Podcast Network. Related service providers are often considered subject matter experts. Our role is to support other members of multidisciplinary teams like teachers, parents, and administrators. But many clinicians I've talked to started their careers feeling like a jack of all trades, master of none. Some feel that graduate school was all theory and no practice. Others feel it was drinking water through a fire hose with way too broad of a scope to feel confident in any specific area. That's why it's so important for professionals in education and healthcare to have a game plan that helps them navigate all stages of their careers so they can uncover interests and talents. In my personal situation, it started when I felt overwhelmed as a new SLP trying to understand my role on the school team supporting language and literacy, which is what inspired me to create Language Therapy Advanced Foundations. That's why I was so excited to connect with Brianna Guild from SLP Literacy Corner, who went through a similar journey. Brianna is a private practice speech-language pathologist in Ontario, Canada. She provides virtual speech therapy sessions, primarily in the areas of literacy, language, and articulation, to residents of Ontario. She started her own small business, SLP Literacy Corner, in 2022. She aims to support busy educators by creating resources and sharing activity ideas aligned with the science of reading. She's passionate about sharing low-prep resources and ideas for students of all ages, so educators can spend less time planning their literacy lessons. Her journey to becoming an SLP was not a traditional one. She received her Bachelor of Science in Biochemistry with a minor in Psychology from the University of Guelph, and then her Master of Health Science in Speech-Language Pathology from the University of Toronto. She loves that the field of speech pathology combines her interests in education, healthcare, and research. In this conversation, we discuss what is it like to be a struggling reader? And we both share our lived experiences going through this. How to discover your niche as a clinician and find your area of specialization. Why evidence-based reading instruction is not just another trend. And talking about how the science of reading has evolved And finally, we wrap up by talking about how to find your people and uncover your version of clinical leadership. Before we get going, I wanted to mention Language Therapy Advanced Foundations, my program that helps SLPs create a system for language therapy. When I first started out, I felt like I was a jack of all trades, master of none, until I went through my doctoral program and really started to hone in on evidence-based instruction for vocabulary and language. In Language Therapy Advanced Foundations, I walk through the framework I created, which was originally designed to help SLPs address the language strand of the reading rope. You can learn more about the program at drkarenspeech.com/language therapy. And I also wanted to mention, on the topic of leadership, if you are interested in learning a framework that's going to help you effectively collaborate on your team so that you can support students' executive functioning across the day, then definitely check out the School of Clinical Leadership. You can learn more about the program at drkarendudekbrannon.com/clinical leadership. Be sure to listen to this entire conversation and check the show notes because Brianna shares some great resources that you can check out to learn more about the language components that impact evidence-based literacy instruction. Now, please enjoy this interview with Brianna Guild. Today, I am joined by Brianna Guild from SLP Literacy Corner. So thank you so much for being here with me today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get going, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
I am a private practice SLP based out of Ontario, Canada. And I also have my own small business, SLP Literacy Corner, where I share free and paid resources for literacy and language.
Well, as we were talking beforehand, I know we realized that we had some similar experiences in elementary school when it comes to reading, which, I mean, for me, I look back on that often and think about how that impacts what I'm doing now. So I'd love to hear what was learning to read like for you in those early years, you know, again, kindergarten, first grade, second grade.
Learning how to read for me, I have very vivid memories of learning how to read. My parents, they always read to me as a child, and I had those favorite books that they had read to me so many times that I had them memorized, and it probably looked like I was reading, but I actually had no idea how to read. In grade one, I remember we had these colorful bins of leveled books. And I remember my friends were moving up in these levels and bins, and I wasn't. I just didn't get it. I had no idea how to read the words in these books. And I remember being taught to look at the pictures to help me read.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always been a very logical person. I need to understand the why and the reasons behind things. So looking at the pictures to figure out the words just never made sense to me. I wanted to know how to read the words. And I know my teachers tried their best to help me with the strategies that they had been taught. Like my grade one teacher, she cut out these little windows out of paper, and I would move them across the sentence to help me focus on one word at a time. But I couldn't read the words. So focusing on one at a time, that still didn't make a difference to me.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the letters, but not what sounds they made or what word they made up. So by grade two, I don't think I had made much progress with reading because I remember very specifically this parent-teacher interview where my grade two teacher told my parents in front of me that I couldn't read. And I remember feeling so crushed because I was trying, but I just did not understand what I was supposed to do to figure this out.
Yeah. It's interesting because your parents probably needed that information, but the way it was delivered probably could have been done in a different way. You know, like they probably did need to know that you needed some intervention, but maybe not in front of you with you sitting right there.
Yes, it became a very core memory for me. So I,
yeah,
in hindsight, might not have been handled in the best way, but for sure was information that they needed so that they could, you know, support me moving forward. And unfortunately, I do think most of that weight fell on my parents because I don't remember receiving any specific instruction in school, but I know that my mom and I went to a Scholastic store or something, mm-hmm. and she bought phonics flashcards and workbooks, and we would do these flashcard drills. I can still picture what those yep. cards look like. And she was the one who taught me with these materials that she had purchased, what all the sounds, all the letters represented, and how to sound out words. And that's when reading finally started making sense to me.
What was your mom's professional background? What did she do?
She was in sales and marketing.
So not an education background.
No.
That's interesting. So mine was, I had a similar experience as far as the timeline. So I was, let's see. So I have a late birthday. My birthday's in August. So
I'm October.
Okay. Oh, so you're even later. And I know that in the US now, and it was probably different when we were in school, but I think it's September 1st is the cutoff date for when you have to turn, like if you turn, let's see. So if you're in kindergarten, you have to be 5 by September 1st in certain areas in order to go for that year. Otherwise, you have to wait the next year. So some parents just choose, if their kids have a summer birthday, to just wait a year and keep them in preschool for another year. And in my school, a lot of parents had done that. So I had just turned 5 and was in school with kids who were almost 7. So I looked way behind, and I was behind, but the discrepancy was even more so. And I remember we moved from in between the summer of first grade and second grade, and the reading teacher, there was a discussion about, should I be retained in first grade because I was, you know, needed some intervention in reading. And I don't remember being upset or traumatized or anything like that. I just remember my mom telling me about it. And the teacher said, no, she should go on to second grade, but you need to make sure that you get her extra help in reading. So that's what my parents did. They did take a lot of that responsibility, but my mom was also a teacher. So she had taught Title I before, so she knew what to do. And also she was able to take me to get supplemental help in the summer. And then when I was in the school that I ended up going to, they did do interventions, and I was in a group, but I remember knowing that I was a grade level below. Like I could tell that my book was different from the other kids, and people would be like, oh, you're in that group, you know, everybody knows, you know, what group is the smart group and which group is the group that's behind. So, but yeah, it's interesting that you said that your teacher, that she was part of the way there, you know, she was teaching you to look at the words, but then there's that next step that needed to happen, which was, yes, we do need to look at the words and we need to focus on scanning, but also we need to do some other things beyond that. So with some of those strategies that your teachers were doing with you, it looks similar to the balanced literacy approach that's really popular. So I'd love your thoughts on that and what you have experienced both as a person who was learning to read and also professionally.
Yeah, so when I became an SLP and started learning more about literacy instruction and started hearing that term being used, balanced literacy, and reading more about it, I knew that the balanced literacy approach wasn't an effective approach for teaching every child to read because it doesn't work for everyone. It didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. I was one of those kids who needed some explicit instruction to learn how to read, and I didn't get that from the balanced literacy approach that was being used by my teachers in school. And I was someone who did catch up after a little bit of explicit instruction, thanks to my mom. And I never had any diagnoses or an IEP. I went mm-hmm. on to be very academically inclined. And yet I still have this history of I needed explicit instruction to learn how mm-hmm. to read. So I've thought a lot about learning how to read, but it wasn't like I had this experience. It stuck with me really strongly forever. And so I decided I was going to teach kids how to read. That's actually not how the journey went for me. I think once I figured out how to read and write, I honestly didn't think about it again until I started taking these literacy trainings as a professional. Once I knew how to read and write, I enjoyed it. I actually wanted to become a teacher because I loved school and learning. And then once I went to university, I wanted to be a professor because then I thought I could teach and do research. I had actually never heard of speech language pathology until my final year of undergrad. I was completing my undergrad degree in biochemistry at the University of Guelph in Ontario, and I decided I didn't want to be a professor or work in a molecular biology lab. I had learned about SLP from a career advisor and started volunteering with SLPs, and I immediately loved how much SLP combined my interests in education and healthcare and research. I went on to volunteer at a few places, including a private practice clinic where the owner had developed a reading program for kids with dyslexia. And I think that was probably about the time when I started thinking more about reading again. I remember her saying that reading wasn't something most SLPs worked on. So
Interesting.
she had me observe other SLPs to get a sense of articulation and language, I think some of those more traditional areas of scope of practice.
I can't believe how many similarities there are between what I did and what you did, except I heard about SLP before I got to my undergrad. I was a deaf education major, and then I switched. So I was in the ballpark. I knew I was doing something education related. I had a lot of people in my family were education, but again, same thing where it was, again, I learned how to read, and then I didn't think about it again until later on, where it was like, oh, this is very similar to what I went through. So, and I also thought that I was going to be doing something academic, which I still like to have my hands in that area, but not as much as I thought. So on the topic of what you just said about how speech pathologists, or at least what you were hearing, that they weren't really involved as much in literacy, which I hope is changing. I'm seeing it change in the US, but when you have to think about all those different areas, you go into an educational setting, a lot of people feel like they're jack of all trades, master of none. They feel like they're a generalist. And typically, there is more prestige associated with being a specialist. And I know that we've talked about how over the past few years, you've kind of made this transition to really wanting to focus on some key areas in your practice. And I'd love to hear what that's been like for you and how you've been able to do that.
Well, when I graduated from school, I started working for a private practice where I still work today. And I immediately started working with a wide range of clients. I really wanted to go into private practice because I wanted to explore more of our scope of practice. And I did take on a lot of literacy clients. I think probably coincidentally, just the caseload I was assigned when I started. But it became something I was really interested in and I wanted to learn more about. So I started taking more training and workshops and took on more literacy clients. Now, in Ontario, Canada, we're not allowed to use those terms specialist or specialty because our college doesn't currently have any specialty certificates of registration. But I have certainly narrowed down my practice areas to primarily literacy, language, and articulation, with literacy making up that bulk of my caseload. And so I took it upon myself because it wasn't something that was given a ton of time in our curriculum and our master's program. So I had to do a lot of professional development once I was taking on more of these literacy clients in order to provide them with the best service that I could. So I've taken a lot of courses, and I'll just mention three. I've done the Hannon Center's ABC and Beyond training, and that's a program that I can use with educators of preschool to kindergarten children to help them promote emergent literacy skills like oral language, vocabulary, story comprehension, print knowledge, phonological awareness, all that good stuff. I'm also trained in the Delivering Smarter Intervention reading and writing curriculum, which is what I use as the backbone of all my literacy assessment and instruction for kindergarten to high school students. And right now, I'm currently completing the Basics of Decoding and Spelling Instruction course by the International Dyslexia Association Ontario branch. And that goes into detail about how to teach basic and complex phonics, spelling, strategies for reading and spelling multisyllable words, and basic morphology.
Love it. And I know I'm familiar with Smarter Intervention. I know it's a really robust program. So yeah, there's so much there. And I love how there's such a range because I focus a lot on the school age populations, but there's those emergent skills as well. And I know that a lot of people want to know, what do I do to get kids ready in a way that is building the skills that they need at that age? Like building those underlying language skills. So that's really important. I think there's a lot of debate about that and how that should look. Like people are concerned that we're forcing preschoolers to sit down and do worksheets, and that's not what we're talking about when we're talking
No.
about effective literacy instruction. It's interesting too that we are talking specific to speech pathology, but I have found that other disciplines, social work, psychology, also experience some of the same thing where they get this broad scope and then they have to figure out, okay, how do I make myself, how do I become a specialist in this area, even if they are working in the schools? And I think the reading and the literacy are, it's a big area where there's a lot of emphasis. So yeah, there's so much we could go into, but I love how with what we're allowed to do legally versus how we present ourselves to people. Like you may not be officially able to call yourself a specialist or say, I have this credential, but we can still make an impact on our practice or how we coach other people. And I know in the US, it varies state to state as far as where SLPs can be involved when it comes to dyslexia. But my thought is always you try to be involved as much as possible, even if you can't use the specific language or
I
the same
agree.
language that you can in other geographic areas. So, on that topic of coaching and working with other disciplines, where do you see how we can kind of tease out what everyone's role is? Like, what does the SLP do? And what does the teacher do? And what can parents do? What are your thoughts there when you've been working with families?
Great question. We'll start with SLPs. When it comes to SLPs and literacy instruction, literacy, like we've said, falls within our very broad scope of practice. And I do think that we have a really important role in literacy. After all, we are the language experts, and literacy is written language. And our knowledge of language and its subsystems, phonology, morphology, syntax, semantics, pragmatics, it's highly important for the identification, assessment, and intervention of literacy delays and disorders. And I think even if it's from a consultation role more in the schools, that we have some of this background knowledge that's very specific to language, and that can really help educate the other members on a child's team, like the teacher, or any other person that's involved, special ed, whoever's involved working with that child. I think that we have a role in supporting their understanding of some of the more specific details of literacy.
I wanted to take a quick break and talk about Language Therapy Advanced Foundations, my program that helps SLPs create a system for language therapy. Not only was I a struggling reader when I was younger, but I was also a struggling clinician when I first got into the field. I had that experience of really feeling more like a generalist than a specialist. And I wasn't exactly sure how to support students' language and literacy as an SLP on a school team. I didn't feel like I got a good system in graduate school just because SLPs have such a broad scope. And I know that a lot of other clinicians, not just SLPs, feel this way when they first get out into the field. So that inspired me to go back and get my doctorate and create a system that really streamlined evidence-based vocabulary intervention so that students can have the language skills that they need to support reading comprehension and writing and all those other skills that are going to impact them both academically, vocationally, and socially. So I outline a framework for addressing components of language that are going to impact things like reading and writing, things like semantics, syntax, phonology, morphology, and orthography. And I give you a framework for supporting them even if you only see students 30 to 40 minutes a week. I give you something that will allow you to customize it so that it is relevant to your specific caseload. To learn more about the program, you can go to drkarenspeech.com/language therapy. Let's talk about flex time in schools. The potential benefits to our students make it worth exploring. More time for personalized learning. Increased choice and agency for students. Dedicated time for intervention. Overall, as school leaders, it gives us and our faculty more tools to increase academic achievement. But the implementation and management of flex time can be a challenge. Tricky logistics and a lack of clear accountability systems can prevent teachers from buying in and can hold us back from ensuring students make good use of their time. I'm pleased to share that MyFlex Learning provides a solution to these challenges and more. MyFlex Learning helps you create and manage flex time for any purpose. Want to see it for yourself? Visit myflexlearning.com/BE to learn more and receive $500 off the first year of use. That's myflexlearning.com/BE. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
When we think about how all of our roles fit together, I always find it helpful rather than saying, you know, this is the SLP's job all the time, or this is the teacher's job all the time, really just to start with what needs to happen, what components need to be in place in order for kids to learn to read. So I'd love to just kind of talk about an overview of how that looks, and then maybe some examples of how that can apply into specific situations and dividing up all the different roles.
When it comes to the principles of effective literacy instruction, like you said, whether it's an SLP, reading specialist, special education teacher, general classroom teacher, whoever it is, we all need to provide children with structured literacy instruction. This is instruction that's evidence-based, explicit, systematic, and incorporates a review of learned concepts. Explicit means we are explicitly introducing and explaining the phonics rules. There's no assuming that kids will figure it out. And systematic means we're following a logical scope and sequence for teaching these rules, typically from easier and more common spellings to more challenging or less common spellings. And the research outlines multiple components of effective literacy instruction. In 2000, the National Reading Panel did a review of reading research that identified the key components as phonological awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension. More recently, in 2020, the International Dyslexia Association identified the key components of structured literacy as phoneme awareness, sound symbol or phoneme-grapheme correspondences, orthography, morphology, syntax, and semantics. And I hope you can see that there's a lot of overlap in those lists.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think oftentimes we're using very similar language and it sounds different to maybe parents or other people who don't have the same language and literacy background, but a lot of these words are being used quite interchangeably. So when I look at these lists and the research, I think one of the major takeaways is that literacy is more than just phonics or just reading comprehension. Mm-hmm. It's more than one thing. And there's many different components that we need to consider and explicitly work on when we are teaching a child in order for them to become a proficient reader.
What I like about the updates are that the original list was, or the original things that were pulled out in the National Reading Panel were good, but we've gotten more specific. Because even, for example, when you think about vocabulary, now we're talking about morphology, which also ties in with phonology, but then we're pulling out semantics specifically, because a lot of times when people think vocabulary, that could just mean so many different things. And it's easy for people to just divert to, well, it means that you can state a word definition. And now we're talking about it more specifically. And that, I think, gives people more context for actually how to work on these skills. And the other thing is, if it's being identified and labeled as something that needs to be within the reading instruction, then our role as SLPs, and we're going to work on semantics, it really, I think it's helpful, because I always felt like early on in my career, it was like almost hurdles that you had to jump over to get people on board with what you're doing. And now it's becoming more common practice. So all good things. And I love that we're focusing more on morphology. That was a big addition that I think was missing in the first round of research.
I think that there's been some really good updates. And another thing to mention too, Scarborough's Reading Rope.
Oh yeah.
I think provides a fantastic visual breakdown of all these different strands. And a book that I read recently, The Reading Comprehension Blueprint by Nancy mm-hmm. Lewis Hennessy, it went into fantastic detail on that language component and specifically how to do direct and indirect instruction on vocabulary, syntax, text structure. That book did a really good breakdown.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have to, I think, for the people who are supporting it, they need more specifics than what they were given before. Besides, well, and again, things that we saw before where it was, look at the picture, guess based on the first letter, the other cueing strategies. And I think one of the things that I find interesting is that some of the strategies that are often taught within balanced literacy, they make logical sense, or there's certain things that are taught that in another context would make sense. And one of those things that I've seen is the context clue strategy, where that's not a decoding strategy. It's a vocabulary word learning strategy when you know how to decode and you can get part of the way there and you need some additional context to understand what the word means. Then you can use context clues, not when you're learning how to decode. And that is that's a really common one where it's, yeah, context clues. This is an effective strategy and people are using it where it doesn't apply. So with that in mind, with all of those things where there are certain subject matter experts who are really in a good position to provide support and coaching to other professionals, parents. So how do you see that playing out as far as just how we can think about coaching other people, or even what resources we can use as a framework for doing that?
So I think whether we're working with other professionals or supporting parents, it's really important that we first take the time to read and understand the research behind what we're doing and any mm-hmm. changes we're making to our instruction, so that we can explain this why to the parents and other educators.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, curriculum updates. I'm not sure what literacy instruction looks like in the schools where you live, mm-hmm. but here in Ontario, Canada, there were major updates made to the Ontario language curriculum in the 2023 school year, which is now, the curriculum is now rooted in evidence-based reading research rather than the balanced literacy approach. It was actually kind of in this in-between stage before, and now it's more rooted in this structured literacy instruction.
Yeah, what can you tell me about that transition and how it's played out?
So I think a lot of people do seem to be right now referring to this transition from more balanced literacy to the science of reading as this pendulum swing in literacy instruction.
Yep.
But I think we need to make this really clear that this is not the case. The important changes that are being made to literacy instruction are backed by decades of scientific research. So when people refer to the science of reading, that's the whole collection of research from multiple disciplines, psychology, neuroscience, education, and it's providing us with scientific evidence for how children learn to read and write and how to best support literacy development for all readers. And this evidence strongly says that we need to use a structured literacy approach and teach literacy skills through systematic and explicit instruction. So I think when it comes to navigating this transition, it's important to help ourselves, other educators, and parents have a mindset that's open to this shift because of the research, because of the evidence for it. And we, those of us who know more about the research, might need to spend some more time explaining the why and the research to others. If parents, educators have questions, we should be able to provide them with answers or find answers to help them understand what we're doing and why this is the current best practice. So one helpful resource that we have in Ontario is Onlit. This is a website that was developed by Dyslexia Canada and the International Dyslexia Association Ontario branch that serves as a comprehensive hub for empowering educators to provide evidence-based, systematic, and explicit instruction that's aligned with our new Ontario language curriculum. And it has tons of helpful resources for both educators and parents. So I think having access to reliable resources, such as those compiled in the Onlit website, is really important when it comes to working with other professionals and supporting parents during this change.
Yeah, that is, it's so important. And I think I tell people that all the time when they want to feel more confident, whether it's just showing up to their sessions directly with students or whether it's talking to their team, presenting at an IEP meeting and sharing information or having a consultation with a family or a meeting with an administrator and you're sharing your ideas, just to be confident in your own knowledge and expertise. I think all of those situations can be nerve-wracking, and you know, it's normal to feel anxious going into some of those situations, but if you have that knowledge, I mean, I've always found that when I'm really clear and I know my content really well, even if I'm nervous, I have that to fall back on. So that's, I've always found that to be a really helpful strategy.
I agree completely, especially as someone who has a research background coming from molecular biology, the principles of research, good research, knowing how to read and interpret the research, all of that has transferred over now into reading research.
And I mean, with reading, it's just, I could go on about the conversations that I've had with people who, when you see the impact that it has on people's lives, if they don't develop those basic reading skills, just their ability to access higher education or job situations. And I know that a lot of times there is a concern that we're not emphasizing the soft skills as well, which of course are also very important. But I was having a conversation the other day with a a family member who supervises people who are in those, you know, entry-level positions, internships, coming out of high school, college, getting their first job. And she works at a museum, and there are some people who do tours or who work security, and they sometimes have to fill out incident reports, and you have to write a detailed written description of what happened, and you have to read forms, or even if you go into retail and you have to take inventory, and you're reading checklists and operating procedures. And I think that we obviously want to make education as functional as possible, but we need those foundational skills too. We can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And some of the conversations that I've been hearing, again, like you said, the pendulum swing, or, you know, we're too focused on academics, but I don't know. I have a hard time believing that focusing on reading isn't going to be helpful for people.
Completely agreed. So the whole reason that we have the new Ontario curriculum was because the Ontario Human Rights Commission, they did an inquiry into the Ontario curriculum and found that we were failing the basic human right to learn how to read. Mm. So like you've said, this is like being able to read, being able to write, literacy skills give us access to participating in society in any way that we want. And the whole reason we have the new Ontario language curriculum is because the Ontario Human Rights Commission did an inquiry and looked into the Ontario school system and found that the school system was basically failing that human right, being able to learn how to read. And so there was this whole right to read inquiry and report that was done up, and the curriculum is based on the suggestions and guidelines that were outlined in that final report.
Mm, that's really interesting. I love how it's, I mean, again, like there's so much as far as equity and access that it's going to impact if you can't read. And I know that certain, you know, people choose different paths after the K-12 years, whether they want to go into the workforce or a trade or higher ed, but it's going to impact all of those things.
Absolutely.
So before we wrap up, I wanted to talk about in this idea of clinical leadership and developing your expertise. I know that you have started some projects on your own in the past year, so I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, in March 2021, I launched SLP Literacy Corner, the store on Teachers Pay Teachers. I decided to start sharing the materials that I was making for my literacy clients, because I thought if I needed to create these materials for my clients, then other SLPs and educators might need these materials too. And maybe people don't have the time to create them that I do. So my mission with SLP Literacy Corner became to support busy educators by creating resources and sharing activity ideas aligned with the science of reading research. I purposefully create low prep resources that can be used virtual or in person and with students of all ages, because I do work with clients from kindergarten to high school. So I need materials that are age appropriate for a wide range of clients.
Great. I love it. So I know that it's SLP Literacy Corner, but I'm sure that other people who are involved in literacy could benefit from them as well too.
Oh yes, absolutely. I've connected with a lot of teachers and homeschool parents. So really anyone that is supporting kids to learn how to read, these resources can be helpful for them.
What would be your advice for a new clinician coming into their field, whether it's SLP or whether it's one of the other related service provider areas, social work, psychology, OT, and they have this broad area where they have to serve and they have to figure out how do I show up confident and figure out where to hone my expertise? What is your advice to someone in that position?
My advice would be to keep an open mind and explore those different areas of your practice and figure out which one really sparks that passion in you. For me, it is literacy.
and then explore professional development in that area, whether it's webinars, training, reading professional development books. And I think it can also be really helpful once you've started diving a little deeper down an area that you think you're particularly interested in to find like-minded individuals, people mm-hmm. who are in your field. So in my case, SLP, who are interested in what you're interested in, for example, literacy. So one thing that I've done is at the end of 2023, I started up literacy professional development book club with other SLPs in the Toronto area. And it was the first time I've started a book club or participated in a book club. And I really felt like I had to put myself out there to ask if anyone would be interested in doing this book club with me. And we'd picked The Reading Comprehension Blueprint by Nancy Lewis Hennessy. And I'm really happy that I found this group because we're all SLPs who see private practice or school board, and we get to share our passion and learning for literacy. And it's been great, especially for professional development books. Sometimes it can be a little difficult to motivate yourself to get yeah. through them and apply everything you're learning. But when you have this group and you get to share what you've learned and share how you're all applying it in your sessions, I think that that makes what you're learning even more impactful. So overall, I would say exploring different areas. And then once you've found that passion, honing in further with training and finding your people in that yeah. group as well.
The last one, that's one where I am always looking to improve. And I told someone the other day, probably the best professional development that I do is having conversations with smart people. And I mean, I've learned so much from interviewing people for the podcast, or even just the conversations that you have in the process of getting people on the show, or just the research that you end up doing and the people you end up connecting with. And I know that it doesn't count for hours, but to me, that's where I've learned some of the best things, is just in those conversations. So where can people go to connect with you and learn more about some of the resources that you offer?
You can find me on Instagram at slp.literacy.corner. I also have a Facebook page, SLP Literacy Corner, and Teachers Pay Teachers stores the same, SLP Literacy Corner. And I also have a website, as well as a email newsletter that goes out bi-weekly. And I share activities that I've been doing in my sessions recently, any cool new literacy finds, and a lot of freebies in those emails as well. So I hope that those make planning a little bit easier for the people who get those.
Thank you so much. We'll link to all of those. And I can't wait to see what you do with it in, over the next couple of years.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to check the show notes for all the fantastic resources that Brianna shared, as well as how you can connect with her and learn more about her SLP Literacy Corner resources. Also, don't forget to check out Language Therapy Advanced Foundations. If you are a language and literacy professional and you want to learn more about how you can support vocabulary, semantics, and syntax that is going to help students build those skills they need to support reading comprehension and writing. To learn more about the program, you can go to drkarenspeech.com/language therapy. And if you have your language therapy framework down and you want to learn how you can emerge as a leader on your team and put a framework in place that supports students' executive functioning, both in your direct therapy sessions as well as across the day, then check out the School of Clinical Leadership. This program is for related service providers who want to lead change management on their team, as well as support others in implementing executive functioning in their classrooms or across or other settings outside the therapy room. To learn more about the program, go to drkarendudekbrennan.com/clinical leadership. As always, it helps me so much if you leave me a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you're interested in being a guest on De Facto Leaders, or if you have a suggestion for a guest, I'd love to hear from you. Just email me at talktome@drkarenspeech.com and let me know. If you found this episode useful, please share it with your friends and colleagues. And as always, thank you so much for listening. I will see you next time. Do you want to simplify your school's technology, save teachers time, improve students' performance on state assessments without just teaching to the test? You can do it all, but don't waste another minute. Head straight to IXL.com/BE to learn how IXL's research-based teaching and learning platform can help you achieve all these goals. That's IXL.com/BE. There are lots of solutions out there for giving students what they need when they need it. But when do they actually do all of those things? You need flexible time. When added into the master schedule, flex time enables students to get extra help or intervention, meet with teachers, make up work, get physical exercise, and try new enrichment offerings. If you're thinking of giving it a try, check out My Flex Learning, which unlocks the benefits of flex time without the common challenges. Its intuitive design makes implementation and training a breeze. Make your flex time work for you. Visit myflexlearning.com/BE to learn more and receive $500 off your first year. That's myflexlearning.com/BE.